Prior to the year 2000, there wasn't a whole lot of talk about non-suicidal self-injury, or NSSI for short. Of course, people engaged in NSSI back then, but we didn't have a common language for the behavior until the mid to late 2000s. A common question people now have is about how prevalent the behavior is and if rates have increased over time. For example, do youth self-injure more now than they did 15, 16 years ago, back in 2007 or 2008? Or maybe rates have stayed the same, but those who engage in NSSI do so more frequently than in the past? Are there any gender differences? To answer these questions and to discuss research about what happens 10 years later to young adults who have engaged in self-injury as adolescents and what can be done from an intervention or treatment standpoint, I am joined today from Lund University in Sweden by Dr. Jonas Bjarhed. Welcome to the Psychology of Self-Injury podcast, a resource for parents, professionals, and people with lived experience. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Westers, clinical psychologist at Children's Health, associate professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, and chair of the Media and Communications Committee of the International Society for the Study of Self-Injury, or ISSS, or simply ISSS. Dr. Jonas Bjarhed is an associate professor in clinical psychology at Lund University, where he also serves as the director of the psychologist program within the Department of Psychology. He's a licensed psychologist and combines his research expertise with clinical work in both inpatient and outpatient psychiatry. His academic pursuits primarily revolve around the study of deliberate self-harm and non-suicidal self-injury. Currently, he's part of several research networks with his primary affiliation as a senior researcher focusing on self-harm behavior in the research group at Lund University, conducting longitudinal research on young people's mental health. He has several other active research projects involving both national and international collaborations. I met Dr. Bjarhed this past summer at ISSS in Vienna, where I also heard him present on today's topic. I think I made things a little bit awkward when we first met because I had him confused with someone else, but he was really forgiving and a super nice guy. The title of his presentation at ISSS was, Do Adolescents Feel Worse Today? Comparing Prevalence of NSSI from 2007 to 2023 in Swedish Adolescents. In other words, do youth self-injure more now than 15 years ago? Or now that we're in 2024, do they self-injure more now than 16, 17 years ago? I found his research results interesting and important and a great topic for discussion on the podcast. So welcome, Dr. Bjarhed. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
How did you become interested in researching self-injury to begin with?
Oh, that's a long story, I guess. But I've trained as a clinical psychologist originally. And from the start, I guess I had some kind of interest in research. Initially, I was a bit involved in internet-administered therapy, ICBT, so CBT administered via internet, basically, but felt that that was perhaps not really where my heart was at. So I started working as a clinical psychologist within our psychiatric services in the public health system here in Sweden. And this was back in like 2005, 2006, something like that. One thing that quickly struck me when I got out there into real life and started working was while there was much that were working really well in psychiatry and a lot of services that we offered that ran very smoothly and where staff was able to work well together and do a really good job, there was also some situations that we met there as a team or as a group of the staff where it struck me immediately that there was very much more varied interpretations and ideas on how to manage and support and help these patients. And they were often younger patients with a number of different kinds of difficulties, but where self-harm was part of the problem picture that they presented with. I think at that time, this was, you know, it was not an entirely new thing, but it was something that still was rather unknown. And as I said here, that there was a lot of different ideas of what this was and what it signified. We didn't use the term NSSI back then. We talked about it as self-harm and many cases actually clinically looked at it as some sort of suicidal or calling it parasuicidal behaviors. So that was something that really struck me when I started working there as a kind of naive observer. That was something that stood out in relationship to the other kind of problems we were working with and patients that we met. During my clinical training, I had come into some contact with dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, which was a really new method at the time. There had been the manual, the books about DBT had just come out in Sweden, and there was kind of a growing interest in this. It was also obvious for me when having that kind of DBT framework that it was very useful to understanding these situations, both the problems that the patients presented with, but also the kind of situations that arose around them, how the healthcare system was struggling with how to best support them while there still were some answers, for example, within the DBT framework for how you could be working with these patients. That was kind of a seed to an interest in this group of patients and managing them or meeting them in a meaningful way in the healthcare system. This led me to, long story short, I got into contact with a professor at Lund University, Lars Gunnar Lund, who later became my supervisor for my thesis work. I got to know that he was planning to launch the first major research project exploring NSSI, amongst other things, in youth in the community in Sweden. So we established a connection there and worked out a way for me to get involved and work in this research project that later then became my dissertation. So that was the background. It pulled me back towards research. And I think that was something that really fitted me to combine the clinical work and the research side of things. Yeah, that's how I got into it.
Wow. So the very study that we're talking about today that started in 2007, you were part of that initial research group from 2007. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of makes both this data, but also the project very personal for me, because my first tasks as a doctoral student was that I went around to all these schools and I met all these kids that were included in our studies, and I administered all the surveys and I interviewed quite a lot of them and got to meet them and their teachers. So we might circle back to that later, but as you know, we have been following this cohort of adolescents then up until basically now. I have the personal connection that I've seen them, I met them when they were 13, 14 years old, and I also interviewed a number of them then and then again when they were in their 20s. So it's very interesting to have that for your inner eye. You can see them there in those situations where you met them.
That is so neat. Yeah, you followed them for so long. I know a lot of people that present and do longitudinal research aren't there at the research project when it first starts, but they jump in later on. But you were there at the beginning of the project we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting because it was 2007 and I was also in graduate school at the time, just beginning my dissertation on non-suicidal self-injury, which, like you mentioned, is not really what we called it at that point back then. It was, that term was brand new in the late 2000s. It was more of the self-harm or self-injury. In fact, we have a lot of listeners who listen on Spotify and we have polls on there. A recent poll asked about people's preference for the term NSSI or self-harm. And a lot of people prefer the term self-harm, I think, at least people with lived experience and people that are not in the research realm. But of course, for research, it's helpful to have the term NSSI to really clarify what we're talking about. But I think in common language back then, this term didn't exist. So self-harm was it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I think it's a really important thing because that kind of simple thing with the terminology, I think, has been immensely important for our understanding of this phenomenon as researchers and clinicians. But as you allude to, for someone who has lived experience for this, it might not matter, or it matters, or one prefers one or the other. And in Swedish, actually, there is no difference. So I have had kind of an issue with this when I was writing my dissertation, because trying to disentangle DSH from the NSSI terminology in Swedish, just have the one construct for both of them, basically. So it's interesting how words, they influence how we think about things, I think. So in a sense, it's important, but in some situations might not be as important.
That's fascinating. I didn't realize that DSH, for listeners, being deliberate self-harm. So in Swedish, in the Swedish language, there is no difference between deliberate self-harm and NSSI?
No, you would just say the same thing, basically. Yeah.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. Well, thinking about your study, I guess we could just jump right in. What are some of your main findings from your research among youth in Sweden? Do youth self-injure more now than they did 15, 16 years ago back in 2007, 2008?
Yeah, that's a great question, which has kept me awake many nights, I think. But yeah, as the presentation in Vienna at the conference, there was some kind of attempt to give an answer to that question, at least for myself. So just to give a quick recap to what I did in my dissertation and also in this follow-up study then. So back in 07, 08, we collected this data that I mentioned. It was a community youth cohort, the first large study in Sweden, basically. And our methodology for this study involved that we covered all the schools in a rather large Swedish municipality. So we visited all the schools and we tried to get all the students in that city basically involved. And we surveyed them with questionnaires about self-harm or non-suicidal self-injury, and also a number of other variables relating to mental health, which we thought would be relevant for kids in this age. They were 13, 14 years old. The main finding from that study, given that we was early out on the research, we found quite high rates of self-harm in this group. Around 40% of community sample adolescents reported having engaged in some form of self-harm at one point or another. So that was the main thing that we took away back then, and that we got quite a lot of attention. It sparked a lot of discussion and debate in Sweden, I would say, within healthcare services, but also broadly in society. Then, you know, you go around and you present your data and read data that others have collected. There's been kind of a debate also among researchers about the trends, the time trends of NSSI over time. And it's kind of difficult to draw really clear conclusions about that, I think, because things always change and there's trends in society and it depends on who you ask, then what happens. A lot of methodological things that can influence rates overall of self-harm if you ask people. What we then landed in now recently, then about 15 years later, was the idea that we would go back to the same municipality, the same schools, and ask them the same questions, the adolescents that are 13 to 14 years old now, and be able to compare those data with the ones that we had collected previously. This was like in parallel to having this ongoing longitudinal project also, where we kept following this original cohort of participants. We basically went back and did the same thing, collected the same data, and was able to compare them for the same city in Sweden 15 years later compared to 07 and the 08. Something about the results, I'll try to summarize. So when we started looking at this, if you begin by looking at the overall rates of NSSI, it appears that they are pretty similar for the cohort as a whole now compared to 16 years earlier. So around 40% or just below that. But the interesting thing, I think, what was both surprising and perhaps a little worrisome was that when we started looking a little bit more closely at this data, we could see that there's probably a bit of an increase in NSSI over these years in girls. At the same time, we can see a bit of a reduction in NSSI in boys. So these two kind of levels out. Overall, it's the same kind of rates, but girls have gone up a little bit and boys have gone down a little bit in their reported rates of having engaged in non-suicidal self-injury. Even more noteworthy, I think, is when you start looking at this even more closely. We have done in all our studies, it's an arbitrary grouping of people, of course, adolescents that hasn't injured at all, those who has injured on a few occasions, and those who have injured 5 times or more, what is commonly referred to as repeated or repetitive self-injuring. And if you look at this group, the ones with more repeated self-injury, it appears that this group, especially among the girls, is larger quite a bit larger than the data when we looked at it 16 years ago. I think that's kind of the main finding. From a bird's eye perspective, it all looks similar, but if you start looking in detail, there's probably some reason to be a little bit worried about young girls in this setting, at least, and about them injuring themselves more frequently than they did 16 years ago.
So to summarize, you went in to the schools 2007, 2008 and surveyed young people there. And then you followed that same group later. But in this particular study, you just went back last year, 2023, and met with the new students in the same grades, the same age, to see if the prevalence had changed with current students compared to 15, 16 years ago, and found that prevalence rates were pretty much the same at 40%, which is really high. It's 4 out of 10, 2 out of 5. And I know lifetime prevalence of self-injury in most countries is about 20% among this age group, so 1 in 5. So it's about double almost in Sweden, which is really interesting. But what I found most interesting in what you're talking about is prevalence rates stay the same overall, but when you looked at the detail looking at gender, it was boys, they decreased their engagement in self-injury. So fewer boys were self-injuring or are self-injuring, but more girls are. But even closer looking at the data, you're saying it's not so much that girls are engaging in it just a few times. There was a significant increase in girls self-injuring much more frequently. So if you broke it down into 1 to 4 episodes of self-injury, and then 5 or more episodes. And so from 2007, the rates for girls who self-injured 1 to 4 episodes decreased in 2023, but increased for 5 or more episodes in 2023, meaning the same number of students are self-injuring as they did back in 2007, but it's girls that are doing it more often than boys. They're doing it much more frequently. And I believe you also had presented that it pretty much holds across all forms and all methods of self-injury, whether that be cutting or some other form of self-injury. So for girls, that's a concern.
Yeah, I mean, it's something to really think about. Comparing one age cohort like this to an age cohort 15 years ago, it's as close as I can think of that you can get to having kind of a matched control or something like that. But it's always the possibility that there's something different with the composition or something has happened that may have influenced on a group level. So you have to take that into consideration. But still, exactly as you say, it's difficult to find any other explanation that girls now, compared to 15 years ago, seem more prone to have this repeated self-injurious behavior. I remember I talked a lot, especially school staff, when we did the initial study. With self-harm, I think you always have to balance between, to some extent, downplay the seriousness of engaging in these behaviors, because a lot of people do it, as we see from this data, and at the same time, not seeing it as something trivial, because that's not true either. So I try to talk with school staff a lot about the possibility of young people experimenting with these kind of behaviors and those kind of possibilities, and that you have to feel them out to get a sense of what it is really about for this or that individual. But what we are seeing now is less that could be easily explained by that kind of just trying it once or twice or something like that.
I think those that are trying it once or twice and then stopping, that number seems to have declined. But those who've done it once or twice and continue, that number is climbing. I'm looking at your presentation. I pulled out my phone and took a picture of it when you were presenting in one of your tables that you had shown and displayed some of the numbers, and found in 2007, about 19.3% of girls had self-injured 5 or more times. But in 2023, 46.8% of girls had self-injured 5 or more times. So that's just a huge number to me. Half of girls self-injuring that often. Here in the U.S., in the United States, there's been a lot of research looking at trends as well. Not so much in NSSI, but in mental health difficulties among adolescents in particular. And there's similar trends among U.S. adolescent girls experiencing more depression, reporting having more frequent thoughts of suicide than boys. And that made a big splash in the news this past year in 2023. It was in a lot of the headlines. And the question that people are wondering is like, well, what is going on? And I know I'm a male here talking about a teenage girl, but I know boys also self-injure. So I'm not ignoring that either. I know neither are you. It's just that it's such an interesting trend to see in what culturally, not only in the US, but globally maybe even, is going on that more young girls are engaging in self-injury, feeling more depressed, having more suicidal thoughts. So that goes to my next question. What are some possible explanations or discussion points for your findings, whether they match with maybe other research that's going on globally? I know a lot of it's just tentative. You can't give any direct like, oh, this is the reason why. I mean, we're going to get into a question about that in the next question. But yeah, what are some possible explanations or discussion points for these trends that you found?
Honestly, we got to admit that we really don't know. I mean, I still think it's important relating to our data here to keep the kind of demographic composition of the participant to account, because we have had big impact in Sweden on demographics with large immigration during a number of years. And I think this could play in some part in this data. It could be the socioeconomical situations for families have shifted a little bit or changed, which could explain some of this change in our data. But that's one thing. And we also have the corona pandemic. It's very relevant. I think we don't really know how it has affected long term different individuals that has gone through that. But yeah, that's something to consider also. I think with non-suicidal self-injury, it's a big shift has been in terms of public awareness and stigma associated with this behavior. And I would say that is the biggest difference that I can see when we talk to young people today compared to when we did this initial study. Back then, this was kind of new and something that was not really talked about. There was a lot less awareness, I would say, among kids about this. And if not a lack of awareness, so at least a lack of more nuanced understanding of what it is and what it's about. So that's also something that's difficult to really know, how much an increased public awareness and a reduced stigma associated with this might make people more prone to reporting these behaviors. And I also think there's two sides of that coin, so to speak. I mean, awareness and reduced stigma is a good thing. But today, I mean, all children this age, I would say they have kind of an awareness of this behavior and a kind of an understanding of why one might engage in it. So I think that the bar for doing this kind of experimentation that we were talking about before is probably lower, or it's more natural, I think in those terms if you're a young person today. But that's just the things that I've been thinking about in relation to our findings we're talking about here today. I think it's an interesting proposition also, which we kind of allude to here also, that we're always talking about young people and their mental health as something that is getting worse and worse and deteriorating. I would guess that we have been talking this way about young people for perhaps decades. And in some senses, it's probably true, but it's also impossible to see a trajectory that is also only going downwards all the time. So that's why I think it's important to do this kind of research and try to do this kind of detailed analysis or look in depth on what they are actually reporting to us and try to interpret that in kind of a qualitative way, not only saying these are the absolute rates and they correspond 100% to what happens in reality, so to speak.
We did an interview with Drs. Maria Papadima and Rachel Atchison in Europe during our last season of the podcast and talked about the use of mental health language among youth nowadays. And so is it a mental health crisis, or are young people using more mental health language to describe the difficulties that come with adolescence having more powerful way of communicating their thoughts and feelings? And so is that the trend? But I'd be curious if you were to continue following these trends and readminister these surveys in another 10, 15 years in those same schools to the same age group, then if there are similar trends or if they've gone down. But also you make a good point about the pandemic. You know, like we know that self-injury had increased during the pandemic, particularly among young people, and that suicidal thoughts increased, not necessarily suicide deaths among the age group, but self-injury did increase. I wonder if this is more of a relic of that, the 2023 findings, and if that will still stay the same in 10, 15 years. But then again, Sweden having such high prevalence rates compared to other nations is really interesting to me. But you did bring up an interesting point related to immigration. So it's something that I'm not as familiar with in terms of what the landscape is in Sweden and in Europe and the immigration and the stressors that come with that. And that may be accounting for some of these increases that you're finding in your research. I'm sure people listening to this have one idea of the cause for this. And so I'm going to just throw it out there right now. A lot of people like to blame smartphones and social media for many of our world's youth's mental health difficulties nowadays, and really, especially over the past 15 years. So if someone were to suggest that these increases in NSSI among girls specifically are because of smartphones and social media, which some people here in the US do, how would you respond?
Yeah, a great question. And I have to underscore that I'm not an expert in research on the effects of smartphones on social media, but I can't really say either that I have seen any research or, for that matter, heard from young people anything that would suggest to me that there is a direct causal relationship between these things and NSSI specifically, not generally at least. I mean, I could probably give some kind of anecdotal stories about some specific cases and situations, very specific, where you have talked to people who are engaging in NSSI where social media has been involved in kind of that process. But those are kind of more specific cases, clinical situations, I would say. But then again, it's not strange to me, if we broaden our view beyond NSSI in particular and look at all the different possible expressions of general well-being or lack of general well-being among young people, this question might become more relevant. You know, does it affect mental health? And again, my understanding is that research probably doesn't really hold up to an interpretation that it is a simple impact or explanation there. But I think it's fair to say that smartphones and social media have changed how young people interact with each other, with the world at large, and what external impressions that they are exposed to are also influenced by having this access to smartphones and the whole world via the internet. So it's probably worth considering that this has fundamentally changed how young people spend their time and what behaviors they are engaging in. All that time that they now spend engaged with a screen, before 15 years ago, they spent that time doing something else. And what could that explain? So in that sense, it has most likely, I think, influenced a lot of things about being young today. And only looking at the strict behavioral level, sleep patterns, physical activity, all those things. If you spend a lot of hours on your smartphone, then there's less hours doing other stuff. So I think it's more reasonable to expect kind of an indirect effect here that might be difficult to pick up in research and that we don't really understand yet. When thinking about this trend, I also think it's worth considering that smartphones and social media and internet and all that has only influenced how young people live their lives, but also how adults live their lives. So it's society as a whole, and it's easy to point at young people spending too much time on their phones. But one might also ask the question, have parents' involvement with their smartphones influenced their strategies, for example? And could there be explanations to these kinds of effects or trends that are even not secondary, but further away still than that? So I think it's fair to say that it must have played some kind of role, but that role is probably very complex than an interaction of different things and on different levels, not only them using phones, but also society as a whole having changed.
There's some research, I think, out of Asia that are coining this term called fubbing, where a parent is basically snubbing their child by using their own phone. They're in the presence of their child, but they're just on their phone, so they're fubbing. And there's some research coming out of those nations that suggests that that actually negatively affects their child, the child's mental health. I'll be curious to see what more comes of that. Kind of a silly term, but maybe I'll link one of those studies in the episode notes just for someone that might be interested in learning more.
That's a perfect example, and it's very interesting. And I mean, I'm guessing that my response here is also clinically, you often use smartphones when working with patients, for example. Having access to a smartphone could be an excellent way of monitoring your emotions, or even having it for mere distraction in a situation that might otherwise have resulted in someone injuring themselves. Yeah. So it's not so much the technology itself. I think it's intricate ways in which we engage with this technology and to seeing kind of the broad consequences of that for society.
And speaking of the pandemic, right at the start of the pandemic, you and some of your colleagues published data from a 10-year follow-up study of adolescents who had engaged in NSSI. Was that the same cohort from 2007, that 10-year follow-up study? Or was it a different group?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the same, yeah.
So what did you find in terms of what happens to young adults who have engaged in self-injurious behavior as adolescents?
That's interesting. And we found out a lot of things, I think, but try to mention some of them. And I might also mention that we had later paper that came out in the end of last year from our group. It's in European Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, if I'm remembering correct. It's a follow-up also where we look a bit more at the patterns and the trajectories of these individuals. How could one summarize this? First thing then, I mean, we have followed these adolescents from 2006 to 2007 and followed up with interviews and survey 10 years later. So a number of them was not available. So we have lost a bit of the sample, of course, as you always do in longitudinal research. But our interpretation is that the rates of self-harm or non-suicidal self-injury goes down. And this is what you might expect and what kind of all research show, that you have this peak in early adolescence that tend to go down. So these 40% of adolescents who reported self-harm in when they're 13, 14 years old, about half of them have ceased or does not report any self-harm when they reach early adulthood. So that's kind of the good news. There's, of course, some individuals that report that they have injured themselves that didn't report it at 13, 14 years old. So this would be kind of new cases, or how you want to view them. The study also allows us to look at those patterns of what happens over time. The other thing that we've been interested in and looking at both in this paper a little bit and in the later paper is what predicts mental health later, and how does life turn out for these adolescents that injure themselves in adolescence. There's some bad news there, or at least not that uplifting, but it seems that those who have injured themselves as adolescents, especially those who have injured themselves a bit more, so five times or more, they have worse mental health as young adults, irrespectively if they have stopped injuring themselves or not. So that's kind of the overall pattern. So having injured a bit more during adolescence is kind of a bad sign for how you'll be feeling then when you are in your 20s. So even if you don't continue with self-injury, then you report more of other kind of problems. There's exceptions, of course, there always is, but that's kind of the pattern. And to me, this reinforces the message that we should take seriously adolescents that injure themselves, especially if they are doing it a lot, because that's probably signifies something about their whole situation, and that situation has a tendency to remain over time if not something is done about it.
Well, as a clinical psychologist, I never like to just focus on these sobering, sad results and prefer to think about clinical interventions. So with these increases, particularly increase of NSSI among girls, but also just boys as well, what can be done from an intervention or treatment standpoint?
Yeah, good question. And it's such a big one, because there's so many layers or levels there, I think. One thing that's always been really important to me is that we really think about the whole spectrum of mental health difficulties and really having some kind of response readily available, irrespectively of where you happen to be as the young person here. So if you have only a little bit of difficulties or you haven't self-injured yet, possibly, then there should be a way of thinking about those people and their needs. To me, there's been a lot of basic research on NSSI, and there's been a bit of research on treatment methods, and there's some really good clinical strategies that you can use, but they are still for specific situations and specific contexts. So healthcare settings, people are pretty knowledgeable in many situations at least, but it's more difficult in school settings and with younger populations. And the kind of mental model from psychologist's perspective is this of a talk therapy with someone that is able to come to a outpatient session and sit down and talk about their situation and then go out in their life and kind of solve problems on their own. That's just a little bit of the puzzle, I think.
Well, I know in episode 34, I interviewed Drs. Kim Gratz and Matt Tall about ERGT, Emotion Regulation Group Therapy. And aren't you part of a large national project there in Sweden that is using ERGT, whether for adults or for adolescents?
Yeah, both actually. And this was something that came as a result from some of the research we did there back in the mid-2000s. And I mean, it was not only us, but there was a lot of people in society identified this as an area where we needed to work out some new ways of meeting these patients. So there was an initiative from the Swedish government, a national self-harm project, which had the objective of improving care and knowledge related to these difficulties. One thing that we did was identify a lack of, you know, viable treatment methods that could be kind of easily disseminated and offered to healthcare staff, because a lot of people, and I think that's still true, they feel that they are lacking the tools or the knowledge on how to respond when they meet patients or clients or in school mental health settings, how to respond to someone who is telling them about injuring themselves. So the ERGT model fit that knowledge gap. So we had Kim and Matt to Sweden, and they trained a number of therapists in administering ERGT. And then this project has continued in Sweden and evolved, and we are still training clinical psychologists, mostly who are meeting patients, to have ERGT groups. And also, as you mentioned, there's also been attempts to make this into a model that could be offered to individual patients in adolescence or in child and adolescent mental health services.
I'm trying to get Drs. Gratz and Tull to come to our hospital and train our staff in ERGT. I'm still waiting to hear back on the funding on that, but that would be really great to be able to reach a lot of people here in the Dallas area, particularly young people. But I'm happy to hear what you're doing in Sweden. In fact, I know Sweden is one of the top 10 countries downloading the podcast the most. So I think there's an audience for that. So hopefully that'll benefit some people there in Sweden. Well, what's next for you?
Yeah, what's next for me? I mean, there's so much more research that can be done relating to the things that we talked about here today. I think one thing that's also close to my heart is the issue of, from lack of a better way of talking about it in English, you know, the most severe patients with self-harm behavior, or the patients that have received different forms of care but hasn't really improved, where I would say that healthcare services has not managed to help them. So those kind of patients that often are treated in inpatient care and have very severe self-harm behaviors and also kind of stuck in a vicious circle where it doesn't seem to improve, and to think about different methods on how to help that group. I think that's also something that has been looked past. DBT is a good example of a stepped care model, which is a step up from ERGT, for example, the group therapy, but there's some patients that doesn't really fit the DBT model either. So some kind of way of thinking about those patients. And we have some initiatives in Sweden also that are very interesting. I think you might have heard of the brief admission protocol, where patients themselves have a contract basically with psychiatric services so they can admit themselves in situations of crisis instead of feeling forced to injure themselves or possibly make some kind of suicidal attempt or actual suicide. So I think that's a new way of thinking about it, at least from how psychiatry has been working in Sweden historically, where you don't want patients to come to inpatient services, but here you flip it around and you invite them and you give them some agency. And those kind of things are interesting for me. So we have a project looking at how psychiatric services here at the hospital in Lund, where I'm also affiliated, how we can better cater to those patients' needs.
Sounds like some really important work that you're getting ready to do, and yeah, very interesting for sure. Well, based on our conversation today, bringing everything together, our conversation about changes in self-injury among youth over the past 15 years, what would you recommend to parents?
What would I recommend to parents? Well, basically, I think it's so important to just talk to young people and to be there and to be present and available to them. Be interested, be curious, try to relate to the world that they are involved in. I think where you see situations where things get stuck between parents and adolescents, it's often related to some kind of, you can't really take the other perspective and understand what the other person is going through. That's not always easy, but that's kind of the only solution, I think, for me also as a parent, that kind of something you can fall back on and trying to think about, trying to understand, trying to put yourselves in the other person's situation and listening and validating. You don't have to agree with what they are feeling or thinking, but you have to let them feel and think whatever they are experiencing, and then you can talk about that.
What would you recommend to professionals, other researchers, clinicians?
I think it's kind of the same there. This curiosity, this trying to actually really being able to relate to another person, perhaps for different reasons. To me, it feels that healthcare services and a lot of other services in society has become more stressed in a way. Psychologists, you're expected to meet more patients. You're supposed to follow strict protocols. You have these different criteria, and for good reasons, because you have to administer a healthcare system also, and you have to have it working smoothly. But sometimes I'm feeling more now than I did initially when I started working clinically, that we lose that connection with patients sometimes. We want them to fit into our boxes a little bit too much instead of being there and being present and really listening and to tailoring what we are doing to that individual that we have in front of us. I don't know if I'm right in this, but it's a feeling I have and it's something that I say.
And what would you recommend to people with lived experience of self-injury?
People with lived experiences of self-injury, I have to say for my own part that they are the ones that teach me all the important things that I know about self-injury, I think. I have met a lot of people who are former patients that have gone through pretty rough experiences of NSSI and of being involved in healthcare treatments and part of those settings. And some of them has really been able to go through that and then come back with a profound wisdom about these things and been able to teach us as healthcare professionals a lot and important things about this. But at the same time, I understand that that is not for everyone. But I think I've seen enough cases to say that for some, that is something that has been really helpful for them and for the healthcare providers that they have contributed to their knowledge. And that would also probably be something that I would say to professionals. Listen to patients and let them be the experts also, or former patients or parents, close relatives, people close to those with lived experiences also have a lot of important experiences. That is something I think. But beyond that, I think anyone who has gone through something that has been difficult. They need to find their way of how they want to then proceed with their lives when they are in a situation when they can put this behind them and move on. So I think it's different for different people.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bjarhed, for sharing the important work that you're doing in Sweden. I know the rest of us throughout the rest of the world can benefit and learn from the great work that you're doing. And thank you for breaking down some of those results that you found and how you interpret them and how they influence what we do in our clinical work on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you. Thank you for this great podcast. I think it's also a very important contribution to all of us that are listening to it.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Psychology of Self-Injury podcast. If you have found this podcast helpful and would like to give back, please subscribe and please help others find us by giving us a 5-star rating, writing a positive review, and or telling your friends and colleagues. If you'd like to interact with us, we welcome you to respond to our questions and polls under each episode in Spotify. This podcast is not considered therapy or meant to be a replacement for therapy, so if you or someone you love is in crisis and needs to talk to someone, you can reach out to the Crisis Text Line, a global not-for-profit organization providing free mental health texting service through confidential crisis intervention, by texting HOME to 741-741. For all things psychology, follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Doc Westers. For all things self-injury, follow ISSS on Facebook and Twitter at ITRIPLES. I'm Dr. Nicholas Westers. Thank you for listening to the Psychology of Self-Injury.